This is an ABC podcast.
For copyright reasons, the music has been edited. To hear the full tracks, listen to The J-Files, Thursday nights on Double J, or head to doublej.net.au and click on the track list at the bottom of each episode.
Hey, it's Kaz Tran here. Welcome to The J-Files, the podcast for people who love music. Each episode is like a quick music history lesson. We pick a different artist or band, we look at some of the most important moments in their career, and we celebrate their impact on music, all in less than 30 minutes. In this episode, we're heading west for an audience with Frio faves Eskimo Joe. It's been 25 years since high school mates Joel Quatermain, Stu McLeod and Cav Temperley came together as a band. And ever since Eskimo Joe burst out of Perth, their irresistible pop rock has had us turning up our stereos. For this very special edition of the J-Files, Cav and Joel are joining us to walk through every step of their journey. Gentlemen, it was 1997, wasn't it, when Eskimo Joe played their first gig?
Yeah, 1997. We formed initially to enter the campus band competition in Perth. Perth was even more isolated than it is today, and the idea of winning the campus band competition is you would get a plane ticket out of Perth to play it, you know, a big gig somewhere else, and that was pretty exciting to us.
Jebediah had won it like 2 years before, and they were kind of, you know, they were all over Triple J and touring and seemingly conquering the world from where we were standing, and it seemed like that was our only route out of Perth. You know, the idea of a record company person or something like that flying to Perth to see bands, we just didn't think that would happen back then. So it was like Jebediah or bust.
And part of the prize for winning the National Campus Bands competition was studio time in a Sydney studio, which is where you recorded your Sweater EP, wasn't it?
Yeah, we won a recording package at Troy Horse Records. Yeah, we recorded the Sweater EP there. We got our kind of four best songs and got in there and smashed them out to tape. And then we were just really lucky that that CD that, you know, we thought we'd sell 500 of them in Perth. Luckily enough, that CD ended up on the desk of Jane Gazzo, who was the evening DJ at Triple J at the time, and she started playing Sweater, and it just took off. And we, once again, couldn't believe our luck, and so we just kind of hit the road and started touring, and that was about 25 years ago. So that's the end of the J-Files, really.
What was that like? Do you remember the moment of hearing your song being played for the first time on national radio?
I do remember myself and Joel having a conversation, which is like one of our goals would be driving with like a girl that we really liked and Sweater, all songs, Sweater coming on the radio and just being like, yes, because we were such huge Triple J fans. I didn't actually have my license, so I was never going to be driving. Joel would be driving. I'd possibly be in the back seat of the Ford Laser.
And it's the least slinky, seductive song of all time.
No, but it was just that childhood dream of hearing your own music on the radio, you know, and it was such a buzz to hear it. But then it didn't just get played on the radio, it got smashed on the radio and became, you know, a bona fide radio hit. I think, as they say, that was when the real work started, because we started getting into these venues and doing that grassroots thing of actually just trying to win over one fan at a time, and we just kind of got on a plane and didn't know when we'd come home. That first run of not actually having a home and just driving up and down from Brisbane to Adelaide, that lasted 10 weeks, and then I think we went home and put ourselves back together for a little while, and then I went, okay, let's do it again, and then we hit the road and we'd kind of built up a bit more of a fan base and we were starting to get some better supports. But basically, by the end of that second 10-week run, we begged and borrowed the last couple of grand off our parents that they would lend us. And we recorded with one of our recording heroes at the time, a guy called Lindsay Gravina, and recorded a second EP.
And then how was that second EP recording? What was that process? A bit more confidence?
Yeah, we had a bit more of an idea of, you know, we were still in this slight novelty pop band thing, but we were, I think what we were doing is, and I think what we've always done is we were reacting to what the crowds were doing in front of us. We were thinking, okay, if we do this little move on stage, everybody applauds, so let's put that into the song. So we kind of put together a bunch of songs based on that, and I think the song that got away out of that EP was a song called Turn Up Your Stereo and another one called Ruby Wednesday. And I think we did one of the last big gigs we did on the East Coast on that second 10-week tour was supporting Custard, I think it was. And our manager at the time just filmed us on a, you know, like a handy cam, and then synced up the footage to the EP that we'd recorded and sent that off to a bunch of record labels. And then that was the first time that we actually started to get some record label interest.
The debut album, Girl, felt like a really deliberate step away from the light-hearted pop-punk fun tunes of those early EPs. Was that the case for the band?
We kind of realised that doing this novelty thing that we were doing, we were getting this instant gratification from the audience, but it kind of felt like a bit of a dead-end road. You know, we had this meeting one day where we were writing songs for that first record and we were still a little bit on the novelty trip. And we just decided this one day, oh, kind of, that's it, let's not do this anymore. And Cav had these other tunes that were like much more in the vein of where Girl ended up being. And from this meeting where, you know, it was almost like a crisis meeting or, you know, a real turning point, like we cannot do this anymore. Like, what are we doing? We don't really love or listen to this music. Why don't we make some music that really resonates with us and we might want to put on at home or whatever? So we decided, we had this meeting and divvied up the strengths and weaknesses in the band. Said, okay, you're really good at this, you're really good at this, you're really good at this, let's do that. And we were just off and racing after that. And from that, we wrote, you know, that whole Girl record and demoed that whole Girl record. And then we're lucky enough to get in touch with this producer called Ed Buller, because we'd since signed with Modular Records, which was Steve Pav's label, who was, you know, in our minds officially the coolest guy in the world, because he was friends with the Beastie Boys and he offered us a tour with The Offspring, and he was definitely the A&R guy who tried the least. And then he really backed us in getting Ed Buller, who was an English guy that was based in San Francisco, who'd made a great record with Ben Lee. And then he came over and did this pre-production with us for 2 weeks on the songs that we'd written, which we thought were, you know, we thought that these songs were amazing. We were never short of confidence in the early days. We got into the room with Ed and he was kind of like, this is not the greatest record ever. We have to work on these songs. And he really caned us in that pre-production. And at the time, it was a bit painful, but later on we were like, we learned so much. Outside a marketplace on earth, there's a subject we all talk about. It's called girls and how they work. We were doing this record and Pav was quite good in the fact that he was like, oh, okay, you guys were a novelty band and EMI are telling me just to give you, you know, some money and just to smash out a pop rock record, but you guys clearly want to make this kind of record and I'll back that. But we were in the studio making this record that we thought was going to be the greatest record of all time. And one day Ed comes back from lunch and he's kind of ashen faced and we're like, how'd that go? How was the record company meeting? Thinking that we were just going to get this praise saying you continue making the best album of all time. And Ed just said, oh, Pav just told me that unless there's two more singles, they're not going to release the album. And we're like, okay, when do we need the singles by? He's like, oh, by Monday morning. Anyway, see you on Monday. And off he went for the weekend. And me and Joe were like, oh, crap. So over that weekend, we wrote Who Sold Her Out and Planet Earth. And on Monday morning, we came in and we played them to Ed. And he was like, great, all right, let's do it. A bit of drama with the record company when we flew to Sydney and decided we didn't want to be on that particular label anymore. And that meant we went into like a 2-year standoff with them. That was really difficult because we were the kind of people who always wanted to be moving forward, and we were caught in this kind of stasis where we couldn't really do anything. But what we could do is just keep working on songs and writing songs. And it actually, in hindsight, was the best thing that ever happened to us because it gave us all this extra time to write a lot of the songs that ended up on A Song is a City. And I think that if we'd moved ahead and made that record like a year earlier, it wouldn't have been nearly as good as it turned out to be. And I think when people hear that second record, they go, wow, this is quite a leap in maturity. Cav's voice has developed heaps. The songs sound confident and adult and those kind of things. And I think that delay in time gave us the opportunity to do that. It's one of the great things about being in Perth as well. You're so far away from the industry and no one's dropping in to see how you're going with the record. You're kind of just left to do your own thing.
Even though we put a lot of energy into Girl to make this record that we really believed in, we were still learning a lot of these tricks along the way, and so there's all these happy accidents and this naivety that comes out in that record. Whereas A Song as a City felt like the first time, you know, from the conception in our heads to what it sounded like coming out, we'd actually nailed it. All of these things that we'd always, you know, hoped and wished would happen started to happen. Like, you know, we started to go from a support band to playing our own shows. We got to play on television shows like Rove, and we got nominated for a bunch of ARIA awards. And that, especially then, was really, really a huge deal to be nominated for all these awards. And I'm pretty sure we lost most of those awards to Jet that year. And the funniest story was, I mean, and this is what I mean about how we kind of ended up at the Black Fingernails Red Wine place, is that, you know, we were there, we were ambitiously going out playing these shows, you know, starting to play these bigger gigs, having international support bands and all these cool things. And then we get to the ARIAs and we were like, great, what do you wear to the ARIAs? So we all went out and bought ourselves suits and we rocked up to the ARIAs looking like a bunch of dorks on their way to a school ball. Do you remember that? And when they were like, and the winner is Jet. And we were like, what? Oh, come on. They weren't wearing suits. They had leather jackets. Their hair was all out looking cool and stuff. He was wearing thongs. And so I think the penny dropped for us at that point in time. I mean, A Song as a City was an album all about being in your mid-20s in Fremantle. You know, your friends are your family at that age and all of the stories that go on between those people. That's really what that album was about. So when I saw Jet got onto stage, they did not look like the kids next door. They looked like a rock and roll band. And so maybe it's not good enough just to be the guys next door. Maybe we need to be rock stars. And so we kind of went home from that ARIA's experience and we were like, great, what does a rock star look like? So I think we all kind of got ourselves leather jackets and, you know, black stretch tight jeans. I dyed my hair black, painted my fingernails black. And then we set about trying to write a record that, you know, a rock star would write. Even with a song like Black Fingernails, how we dressed it up, it was, you know, we want this to sound like it's in a dark underground gothic club somewhere on Manhattan or something. So we put the kick drum through a guitar amp and mic'd it up from the other side of the room so it sounded like a dingy nightclub and that kind of stuff. So we really went for that kind of thing. But I must say, you know, generally, like the lyrics that Cav wrote, apart from that song, maybe were, you know, they're pretty personal stories, and it was just the way we dressed it up was a bit different. And I know I should stay back, and I know I should stay back. One of the funny things about that record is, even though it's thematically, lyrically, and everything about it is this like long dark tea time of the soul kind of vibe, for an album that sounded like we were meant to be kind of pretty dark, we were in a pretty sunshiny place. We were having a great time. Everyone was on board with the sounds and the songs. And it was, my memory of making that record was just, a harmonious experience. So that is possibly one of the reasons why the stars aligned around that album, because everyone was just in a really good place with it.
And following the huge success of Black Fingernails' Red Wine, is it fair to say that you guys kind of threw out everything you learnt and brought a bit more risk into play for Inshallah?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think Inshallah, well, I'd actually been to Egypt with our manager, who is part Egyptian, and we'd stayed with her family. And everywhere you go in that part of the world, they're like, Inshallah, you know, which means God willing, or, you know, what shall be, or good luck. And I just thought it was such a beautifully musical word. And at that point in time in the world, you know, there was a lot of tensions between Christian and Muslim people fighting over the idea of God. I'm not a religious person, but I thought it was a beautiful statement to use this word, which really did represent the bunch of songs on the record, What Will Be Will Be. And I just thought, you know what, let's put this as the title of our record. It's a beautiful sounding word, and I think that transcends the bullshit that's going on between everybody. And there was a lot of talk between our record label and our friends and family of whether it was a good idea or not to use that title, because it was a bit provocative. But I still stand by us using that title, because as a offering of peace to everyone, of like, this is a beautiful word, this is a beautiful language, this should transcend whatever political crap is going on right now.
When we were kids, we never looked down. Run off the edge, we never do it now.
There was more change for you guys ahead of the making of your fifth album, Ghosts of the Past, too. Tell us about that, Cav.
Outside of the title and outside of all of that stuff, one of the most amazing things about that record is, you know, we ended up recording that record with Gil Norton, who was one of our favourite producers. He'd recorded Colour and the Shape by the Foo Fighters, all the Pixies albums, who were like, you know, Pixies were one of our all-time favourite bands. And one of the comments he made, he was like, look, the thing about your last record is it sounded like a band on cruise control. Gil was all about the kick drum and the bass and the dynamics of the band to keep the listeners' interest. So we had a lot of experimentation on that record on playing with rhythms and sounds, trying to keep the listeners' interest, and really learning so much from this master of making records.
Approaching your sixth record, what were your individual mindsets coming up to Wastelands in 2013?
We knew that it was going to be the last record we were going to make for a while. We'd had some conversations, like Joel was really keen to go off and, you know, sink his teeth into some production work. Everyone had other projects they wanted to jump into for a while. So we thought, you know what, let's just freak the shit out of everyone and do something really over here that we can walk away from and be like, cool, that was a really fun and interesting record to do. So we got Burke Reed, who was kind of one of our peers because he played in Girling and stuff when we were first playing in Eskies, and he'd gone off and made some really interesting records in the meantime. So we brought him in knowing that he was going to throw some massive spanners in the works. We wanted to do something just left of centre. And he delivered. He challenged us massively, but it was a difficult record to make for different reasons. I was going through a marriage breakup at the time, and so I was having these hideous scenes in the car park and then having to walk into the studio and sit down in front of the microphone and sing. And there's a song on the record which I love called Disgrace, and I just had this, like, one of the worst kind of moments of my life moments. And then I had to sit down. I was like, usually I would stand up when I would sing, but I had to sit down in a chair. And you can kind of hear me on the recording going, and then going, getting into the vocal. And part of that is really amazing because it's capturing a real moment in time. But for me, I find it almost impossible to go back and listen to that song because I'm right back in that moment.
Disgrace, disgrace. My father and his father before him. I don't know if I sink or swim.
One of the coolest things that happened recently was we did a bunch of shows with symphony orchestras around Australia. They had about 8 composers come in and rework our back catalogue into like a 2-hour show of everything we'd done. And we really wanted to get some songs from Wastelands and put them on there. One of our favourite songs that came out of that session was a song called Running Out of Needs. It was a great song. We never really got to play it live properly, but when we played it with the orchestra, it just all made sense. And, you know, we put out a record of that performance of the live at the Perth Concert Hall with Wozzo. And so you can hear the orchestral version of Running Out of Needs, but I love that version of that song, and I loved playing that with the orchestra because it really, it just gave that song the time of day that it deserved.
So interesting hearing you both talk about the very deliberate spanners you would throw into the works. It's funny on one hand, but also really intense on the other. But really, at the end of the day, it's what creating art is all about, isn't it?
Well, early on, we were talking about being, you know, ambitious and careerist and all that sort of stuff, but we regularly committed career suicide with the artistic decisions we made. I think it was like we could have done the Can I name another band? No, I shouldn't. Who makes the same record each time? They've got their lane and they know it, and their fans connect with it, and it's like they're just driving straight up that road. And we always chucked a hard right or a hard left in Eskimo Joe just to keep ourselves interested.
To comment on what Joel was saying is we always believed in our love of songwriting and that we could write, you know, a song that we believed in. And really it was about keeping interested for ourselves, but also going back to the Beatles, you know, like the Beatles would do that every record, you know, they would react against the record before them and try and do something completely different. And it was always based on great songwriting. So I think we always had that idea that even with the Songs of City, you know, that was a different record to Girl, you know, and even Girl to our EPs, that was completely different to that. Black Fingernails, Red Wine, that was a risk to do that record, but it worked, you know. So each step along the way, I think we were continuously trying to find new ways to change up the formula to see what successes would come out of it. And sometimes there was good moments and sometimes there was moments that didn't connect.
I hope you've enjoyed this generous serve from these classy songsmiths, showcasing the breadth of their talent from their early days writing about sweaters to collaborating with the West Australia Symphony Orchestra. The J Files is a Double J podcast. Make sure you like, follow and share. Our producer is Sam Wicks, with production support from Gab Burke and Phoebe Bennett. Theme music is by Art vs. Science. You can check out Double J anytime on the Triple J app or at doublej.net.au. I'm Kaz Tran. Thanks for listening.